forgotten his name. Left it in a heart somewhere, no one to remind him. Told it to a stranger, she took it away. There comes a time when you understand.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of American Exposé. I'm Darren Weeks, your host here for the next hour as we focus our attention on a crisis of our republic, the undermining of our individual liberties, and the energy crisis that never was. Ladies and gentlemen, for about the last week now, I've been sharing information from Lindsay Williams' book, The Energy Non-Crisis. And I'm going to continue that again tonight. And the reason we're doing this, folks, is because you need to understand the manipulations that are going on in place and the regulations that are being in place upon the oil companies in order to drive up prices. The more regulations that you have, the more restrictions that you have, the more hoops that companies have to jump through in order to be able to conduct business on a regular basis, the higher prices are going to result naturally as a result of that. And I want to make sure that you understand that a lot of what we're being told today about an alleged energy crisis is nothing but lies. We live in a day where we have nothing but deception all around us. We live in a day where everything that we're exposed to by the controlled press and the controlled electronic media is nothing but a bunch of lies. We can't believe anything we're told, and yet, unfortunately, most Americans believe everything that they're told. Because if it comes from official sources, why, it's absolutely got to be true, doesn't it? I mean, a good example of that are local media personnel. I have a lot of experience, for those of you who do not know my background. I've worked in the broadcast media for over a dozen years now. And so I've worked very closely with local media news operations. I've seen how they conduct their business. And I can tell you from personal experience that information from official sources, quote-unquote, is treated like gospel unless they have a reason to treat it any other way. In other words, press releases from the police department, it's treated like there's no question that it's anything but true. Nothing is ever questioned unless there's a specific sign of corruption or some reason why it should be questioned. Otherwise, they take it, they report it like it's fact because it came from official sources. If something is reported on the Associated Press, well, the Associated Press isn't going to lie. We're talking about a bunch of the best journalists there are, right? And so it's reported like it's gospel. Nothing's ever looked into. So, in many respects, the local media is just as controlled because they're ignorant of the big picture. They're ignorant of what actually is going on out there. They're ignorant of... So, folks, that's the reason why we have an alternative media. It's to set the record straight about what's really going on. And so tonight, we're going to share with you from a guy who was there. A guy who was there, who saw the oil fields, who saw them find oil and spoke to the executives, who spoke to him candidly and told him of numerous finds, numerous square miles, countless square miles of oil fields that the federal government had ordered not to be developed. And folks, I got to tell you, as I was just talking to Chris Gerner the other day, as we generally talk once a week, every time I read this book from Lindsay Williams, I feel like crying. I feel like weeping for America, because the things that he tells about in this book, it's a deliberate effort to bankrupt this country, a deliberate effort to enslave this country. It's all about control, folks. As I said last Monday on this very broadcast, The reason that we're in the Middle East is not about oil. That's what they want you to believe. If you believe that we're in the Middle East because of oil, then you are operating within the dialectic of the controllers. Because we are not in the Middle East about oil. We have our own oil here. We have enough oil here. And that's the information that we're sharing with you tonight. They want you to believe that we're in the Middle East because of oil, because everyone's going to think, well, we got to be in the Middle East then, because we have to have oil. And so the plan for control of the world moves forward. They can invade country after country after country after country and take control of those resources and those people in order to fulfill their agenda on the pretense that we need the oil, that we need the energy. Because that's the plan that's in place, folks. It's about control of the world. It's about control of, yes, the minerals and the oil and everything in the earth, but it's also control of the people of the earth. And that's what it's all about. So without further delay, and folks, there's a lot of information that I've already covered, and I have been skipping some because I don't want it to get monotonous in any way, although this book, frankly, is not monotonous. It's very interesting, every part of it, but some parts are more relevant than others, and I've been trying to share the most relevant so that you get the big picture about what is really being put into place for all of us. And the crisis, the Hegelian crisis that's being put into place for us. And so I've been, if you would like to order this, I will have an 800 number that I'll give out toward the end of the broadcast. Hopefully I don't forget. But there's an 800 number that I can give you that you can order this book. You can read it off the Sweet Liberty website. It is in the Sweet Liberty website somewhere. I forget where we put it. There's a little section called Books Online, and I'm sure it's cross-linked in there. But I urge you to get this book. And when you do, tell him you heard about it on our broadcast, okay? So that he knows that he has a response. Because we'd like to get him back. And we'd like to talk to him some more. It's very important that we support the people who are actually coming out with good information and sharing this stuff. And the book that I have in my hands, he sent to me free of charge. He sent to me all of his other books free of charge. I know he can't afford to do that for everyone. He did make a special offer on our broadcast that if you'll buy his video, he'll send you the books. So just call that 800 number that I'll give out toward the end of the broadcast, and you can ask them about any special offers like that. But at any rate, I want to get right into this. He was sharing with you, on Monday's broadcast, we shared about a toilet paper holder that cost $375 because of union issues. All the people that were involved, it took like three different people plus their supervisors. So I guess a total of six people to install this this toilet paper holder. So at a total cost of $375. Now that was a union issue. We shared with you also on Monday about and though the union issues added up, he says we're not going to major on those things because really the biggest problem was with the government and the insane environmental regulations. For instance, he talked about the Falcons. They had a pair of Falcons in the road that they were building, and they had already gotten all the permits to do this, to build this road, and yet this eco-management person from the government, environmental nut from the government, was out there and inspected and discovered that there was a Falcon's nest, which he said was an endangered species. And he said it can't be disturbed at any cost. And the guy argued with him from the oil company. And he says, no, it doesn't matter. I've got my job to do, and I'm going to do it. And the road doesn't go through. He expected the oil companies to wait until the Falcons were done nesting, until the eggs had hatched, before they went forward. Now, bear in mind, folks, that they're paying people to be out there. They have to pay these people whether or not the project goes forward, you see. So they can't afford to sit there waiting for these Falcons to finally nest and get done nesting before they continue paving the road. And even if they did wait, which was, you know, it's an impossibility in the first place because it's so ridiculous and they can't afford it. But even if they did, how do you know the guy's not going to find another nest or something else? He would have. Because, see, that's the point. They didn't want the project to go forward. And that becomes increasingly obvious as we go through this book. The federal government did not want this pipeline to be built. And that's the sad part about it. So ultimately what the oil companies had to do, and I'm recapping here, I'm going to get to the new material here shortly, but they had to take the road a different direction. They had to actually build the road around these nesting falcons rather than move the nest and disturb the precious species that were nesting there. Folks, that's the insanity, the absolute insanity of this system that they are putting in place upon us. Someone said, and Chris related to me, that, and this is a very good analogy, with this system that they're putting in place with sustainable development, eventually it'll be where the human beings are all be in the cages, and it'll be the animals that are looking in on us. I couldn't have said it any better myself. And I don't know who that statement originated with, but it's very succinct and it's very accurate. Without further delay, let's move along here. Lindsay Williams, in his book, The Energy Non-Crisis, writes, "Now I had been chaplain on the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline for 2 years. I had spent 2 years watching and examining in constant contact with the men who were planning and then undertaking the construction of this great project. Now it was all beginning to add up, and here is the way it looked. In 1971, the oil companies had first proposed the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. At that time, the projected cost was $600 million. That was the anticipated figure in 1971, but before it could actually begin in Alaska, the government stopped in and said, no, until more surveys are undertaken and more guidelines have been laid down in such areas as the protection of the ecology, you will not build the pipeline. The nine major oil companies of America had hauled that big pipe from Japan to Alaska. It's interesting to notice that the pipe itself had been built in Japan because prices were already beginning to go high, even back in 1971. By that time, it was cheaper to buy it abroad and ship it across the water to Alaska. So it was that an American bank financed a Japanese steel company for the purpose of building the pipe for the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. While the pipe was actually bought and made in Japan and then shipped to America, it had to be stored from 1971 until 1974 in pipe yards in Fairbanks, Valdez, and Prudhoe Bay, three sites in Alaska. Then, in 1974, the pipeline began to take shape. The government had issued their permits, surveys had been made, the ecology had been studied from 1971 to 1974, and an entirely new method of building the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline had been devised. At that time, inflation was beginning to cut even deeper into the American economy. There was an increasing spiral of inflation in the early 1970s. Up to that time, the prices remained more or less the same year after year. When the pipeline began to be initiated in 1974, the cost estimate was no longer $600 million, but $2 billion. Moving on to 1976, it was interesting to stand and look back and also to look forward. In 1971, the figure was $600 million. We needed the oil at that time, but there was no energy crisis. Nevertheless, the country needed oil and private enterprise could produce it. However, the oil was on government-owned land, and so the project was stopped until government had their say. In 1974, the project cost was $2 billion for the cost of that pipeline. Now we reach 1976. And the oil company officials were saying that because of cost overruns, the total cost of the oil pipeline would probably exceed $12 billion. At that point, it was all beginning to add up. I was beginning to realize that there was indeed something in the wind. There was an underlying force that was attempting to control both the oil companies and the flow of oil. From 1976 on, frustration began to be intensified. Permits were withdrawn. Even though they had been issued for the entire time of the oil construction of the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline and had been promised as such by the federal government. Now, I was watching as one after another, they were withdrawn, the permits, in an attempt to frustrate the entire project. Now, folks, one thing I meant to mention at the outset of this broadcast when I was doing my recap, there's situations that I covered on Monday's broadcast, which if you did not hear, it'll be in the archives, and I urge you to go back and listen to it, or else get the book and read it for yourself. That would probably be the best situation to do. But he talked about outhouses which cost $10,000, which were mandated to be brought in, rather than put the manure of the personnel on the tundra, which could have been fertilized by the manure. It certainly wouldn't have done any harm. The government mandated that these $10,000 outhouses be brought in, and then they had to have a Mercedes engine attached to them. And the Mercedes engine, of course, was extra. So it was a lot more than $10,000. $10,000 plus whatever the cost of a Mercedes engine. And that was for the purpose of incinerating the manure of the workers so that they didn't have to dump the manure. It's just insane the stuff that they did there. And all of it, it made no sense to anybody unless you figure that the whole purpose was to bankrupt the oil companies. And that's what the executive said. This executive, he said, Mr. X, to protect his identity so he didn't get fired. That was the purpose, was to bankrupt the oil companies so that the government could come in and nationalize them and take them over so that they would have the control. Now, I also find it interesting, too. He covered the fines. If anything, any slightest little violation of what they said, it was an automatic $10,000 fine. And he said that they were using fines like crazy. If a truck drove off the road, it would be a $10,000 fine. If somebody turned around on the river, he says a lot of times you couldn't even tell. You couldn't even tell they had driven in there. And yet, it was a $10,000 fine. Somebody threw some hot dogs down. And it was an automatic $10,000 fine. It was insane, some of the stuff, and we shared that on last Monday's broadcast. So if you weren't listening, get the book, and we'll give the number later on. But I want you to understand, I want you to get the overall picture of what happened there, because, folks, that's part of the reason why you're paying so much at the pump today. And as I said last Monday, if it was going on then, it's going on today. The regulations, the control, the ridiculousness of the situation. Continuing here, Lindsay says, now I was watching as one after one, the permits were withdrawn in an attempt to frustrate the entire project. Regulations were being intensified. There had been plenty of time in 2 years to update the regulations by which the government controlled the whole operation in such manners as the protection of the environment. I remembered that first book dealing with regulations that I had taken to my dorm room in 1974. Even at that time, I had read through it very carefully and wondered at what I had read. Private enterprise was building this immense pipeline, and yet was told what to do in minute detail, having to get specific permission at all sorts of points from the federal government, even though that government was not putting one penny into the entire project. I was watching as their permits were being withdrawn and even more stringent regulations imposed. And it indeed seemed that the federal government did not want the oil to flow. The oil was found on federal and state lands north of Brooks Mountains. And most of the land was owned by the federal government. 92% of the land in Alaska is owned by the federal and state governments. Did you hear that, folks? Only 8% is owned by individuals, so the oil is on government-owned land. So it was that the oil companies were told what they could do in very great detail. I had always thought of the government as having been elected by the people, for the people, and of the people. So surely the government would want what was best for the American people. You see, this is how people wake up, folks. Once you're molested, that's when it happens. It's unfortunate that many of us have to be molested by the government before we finally wake up to what it's all about. And this obviously was Lindsey Williams' awakening. He says, surely we have not lost sight of the fact that private enterprise has made this nation so great and prosperous. That has been so since the time of our forefathers devised the method of incentive to allow private companies to develop and produce. This land in Alaska was owned by the federal government, and therefore, is not this the land of the people of America? Did they really not want the fuel to be produced? If that was the situation, then why? There was supposed to be an energy crisis. Then I remember that Mr. X had said that the oil companies had been allowed to produce the oil for the Trans-Alaska oil pipeline from only one 100-square-mile area of this North Slope of Alaska. And I remember that the North Slope of Alaska includes many times 100 square miles. Mr. X had said that all of the land of the Brooks Mountains included many pools of oil. It was there in vast quantities beneath that north slope. Nevertheless, private enterprise and the oil companies of America are allowed to produce from only one of those pools. They have been deliberately limited to one 100 square mile area. Then I remembered that precious tundra that seemed to be all I could hear about on the news and from the ecologists. The cry constantly was, preserve the tundra. The tundra was so precious, yet I actually watched them lay large areas of styrofoam for insulation under the road, a road that was nothing but gravel. I watched them bring in truckload after truckload after truckload of large sheets of styrofoam, and then they would lay them straight under the tundra, and then the gravel would be put up on top of that. They would lay a gravel pad on top of that styrofoam just to keep the ground from thawing and to preserve the tundra. I watched reseeding take place after they had laid the pipe. I thought of those men who were literally fired because they happened to drive a bulldozer out on the tundra, off the road that had been built, a road that was actually a road laid out across the bare north slope. I remember that I had watched the caribou who had never seen humans before, and that I thought I watched, and I had watched the bears that did not know that they were supposed to be afraid of us, walk right into the camp. I knew that their migration paths had never been disturbed. Even the wolves had no fear of man in these areas. It seems rather strange that today, about 3 years after the oil pipeline had been completed, that its construction did not destroy the environment or disturb the tundra, or other aspects of the environment in any major way whatever. Let us summarize a few facts that we have already presented, and some others that are just as relevant. I thought back to those two falcons that could not be disturbed while they were nesting, and so $2 million had to be spent to reroute the road, rather than to disturb them at the time. $1 million per falcon. Next, I could never forget that large flotilla of barges that were brought each year from the west coast of the lower 48 states, bringing all the supplies and equipment necessary for the Prudhoe Bay oil field. Entire buildings and other constructions had been assembled in the lower 48 and placed on huge barges and floated by way of the Pacific Ocean through the Bering Sea and then into the Arctic Ocean and eventually across to Prudhoe Bay. Each year, one of the highlights was when the flotilla of barges came in. They brought everything from the big pump stations to the flow stations to the pipe itself. They brought in vehicles, dormitories, and everything necessary in such a way of large construction equipment such as drilling rigs and on and on. They brought in everything that was needed for the work of producing oil from the fields at Prudhoe Bay. Then in 1975, the weather just simply did not cooperate. That flotilla would have to wait until the Arctic ice had left the ocean. The flotilla would usually stand for weeks at a place called Wainwright. They would wait for the ice to move at Barrow, and then they would have only a few days to get in and get out. We would hear the message, the ice is moving, the wind is moving from north to south, there's a shifting. So they would move out into Prudhoe Bay. In 1974, the fleet had plenty of time to get around Point Barrow and into Prudhoe Bay, and to get back again to the lower 48 in protected iceless waters for the winter time. However, this year, 1975, the weather simply was not cooperating, and every single hour was precious. Every moment had to be counted. Finally, the ice broke just long enough for the flotilla to come around by Wainwright and Point Barrow. Then it arrived at Prudhoe Bay, but something was wrong. The ice was barely staying offshore, so the flotilla did not have time to get back out. The ice closed again, the wind was not favorable, and soon it was clear that the flotilla of barges and the tugboats that brought them in would be stuck at Prudhoe Bay for the winter. They could not get out again. This presented a problem. Before the Arctic Ocean and the Beaufort Sea closed, Beaufort Sea closed in again, somehow these barges had to be lifted out of the water and brought onto the land. However, the water is very shallow close to the land at Prudhoe Bay, and the barges were a long way from shore. The equipment was brought in piece by piece, but then there were expensive barges owned by the companies and the tugboats that brought them in. How could they be saved? There was really only one way, and that was to build a dock. Why not? Put gravel out into the ocean and dock them on dry land so that the ice would not crush them in the winter. Then I watched, knowing that time was precious. The federal bureaucracy cares nothing for time and seems to care nothing for private enterprise. The fact that they had millions of dollars in equipment tied up there, sitting out in that water, mattered little. The water was gradually freezing in around the barges, and it would crush all that equipment while they were deciding what to do, and that is exactly what happened. The ice closed in around those big barges. We got to take a break, folks. We'll continue this on the other side of the break. You're listening to American Exposé. It's amazing, just amazing how time flies here. We got a lot more information to cover, short time to cover it. Stay with us. We'll be back. Stay with us.
What in the world is going on? Stay tuned to FirstAmendmentRadio.com to find out first, and on satellite to Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70. You are listening to the Worldwide First Amendment Radio Network. We do not have freedom of speech because the Constitution gives it to us. The constitutional amendment was written to keep the government from taking our freedom away. The Creator gave us our rights, but He also gives us the capacity to do evil or usurp the rights of others. Our individual rights end where the rights of another begin. No one has the right to do evil because evil can never be right. Those who would seek to limit your right to speak or hear the truth are the same who seek to subjugate, control, and enslave you. Freedom is not free. Support the Worldwide First Amendment Radio Network by going to FirstAmendmentRadio.com on the Internet and following the instructions there to support us. Thank you for listening.
Most Americans want our government to control our borders, especially since 9/11. But amazingly, some political leaders want to do away with borders entirely, whether the American people agree or not. And they have a serious plan for accomplishing their aims while deceiving the public. It's called the Free Trade Area of the Americas, or FTAA, a huge power grab. If Congress approves the FTAA, our nation will be pushed down the same path that produced the European Union. There will be no more illegal immigration because there will be no enforcement of borders. Americans will lose control of their destiny as regional bureaucrats from corrupt political systems decide our future. Sound incredible? Check out the facts for yourself. Go to stoptheftaa.org. Then tell Congress you want a better future for America. That's stoptheftaa.org.
Welcome back to the broadcast, American Exposé. I'm Darren Weiss. I told you folks before the break, or at the beginning of the broadcast, by the way, this is April 15, 2005. I don't think I gave the date at the beginning here. April 15, 2005. At any rate, I told you I would give you a toll-free number that you can order Lindsay Williams' book, The Energy Non-Crisis, and folks, I want to do that. The number is 800-321-2900. Again, that's Lindsay Williams' order line, 800-321-2900. 800-321-2900. Again, that number, 800-321-2900. And that's to order the book, The Energy Non-Crisis, by Lindsay Williams. I highly recommend this book, folks. I highly recommend that you order more than one. Because, folks, this is a book that every American should own. Every time I read this book, it really makes me want to cry for America. So I highly recommend it. The Energy Non-Crisis by Lindsay Williams. And again, the 800 number, 800-321-2900. Again, 800-329-2900. And I know that he is in this to get the message out. And that's the purpose of it all. So before the break, we were sharing with you how they had these barges on the water. And he says the water was gradually freezing in around the barges, and it would crush all that equipment. While they were deciding, they being the federal government, while the government was deciding what to do, that is exactly what happened. The ice closed in around those big barges. They were able to save the tugboat, but the barges were left in the water because there was some microorganisms, they said, on the bottom of the Arctic Ocean at that point, and the ecologists insisted that they must not be destroyed by the building of a gravel dock out onto the water to the point of the barges. He says, I watched as the big equipment was brought in. They were actually, now get this, folks, they were actually outfitting bulldozers so that they could ride the bulldozers on the bottom of the ocean and literally go up to the place where the barges were and pull them in. He says, I saw huge nylon lines, bigger than I had ever seen before, brought in. They said that the big dozers would literally pull the barges in, but then no, surveys would have to be made. It would have to be found whether they were going to destroy any of those microorganisms and the little minute fish that swim on the bottom of the Arctic Ocean for only a short period each summer. The argument was that by taking those dozers out in the middle of the ocean for only a few hours, especially equipped as they were to pull in those big barges, they just might somehow destroy those microorganisms. In this area, even though it runs for hundreds of miles, and folks, the point here being is that hundreds of miles, we're talking about a very small area of this, hundreds of miles of ocean, and how many more microorganisms, and we're talking about an area that's never seen man before. Never seen man before. So even if they destroyed some of those precious little microorganisms, you got hundreds of miles of ocean there. There's going to be other microorganisms. There's going to be others of these fish. We're talking about a lot of equipment and a lot of expensive stuff here. They said surveys would have to be made. It would have to be found out whether they were going to destroy any of those microorganisms and the little minute fish that swam on the bottom of the Arctic Ocean for only a short period each summer. The argument was that by taking those dozers out in the middle of the ocean for only a few hours, especially equipped as they were to pull those big barges in, they might somehow, just might, destroy those microorganisms. In this area, even though it runs for hundreds of miles, we did not dare disturb the ecology, and surveyors must make their tests before the dock could be built or dozers could be used to bring the barges in. Lindsay says, I watched as they stalled and stalled and stalled for time until they had finally stalled long enough. The barges froze and cracked and popped. The big steel plates were literally destroyed, and millions of dollars worth of equipment was crushed by ice. Why? Could it be that the government did not want that flow of oil? Could it really be that there is no energy crisis except the one they want to produce? Then came that $10,000 outhouse to mind, to which we've already referred. Why $10,000? Just to prevent the tundra from receiving needed fertilizer? And remember, nobody tried to put diapers on the caribou and the bears. No other company in America had to pay that price for an outhouse. They do not require such extravagance in our polluted population centers. Yet there was no pollution except for the pollution that was coming out of the smokestacks of those same $10,000 outhouses. You could smell it for miles if the wind happened to be blowing in your direction. Further, he says, I noticed sewage systems were having their permits withdrawn from Galbraith Lake all the way to Prudhoe Bay. All withdrawn even though they had been issued for the promised life of the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline construction. Now within 9 to 12 months before the completion of the project, sewage systems were being removed. Why? The water coming from them was perfectly pure. They had met all regulations and standards. They had been approved and permits had been issued, yet orders were now being issued for these sewage systems to be removed, and new ones at exorbitant cost were being brought in for one more year of the life of the construction of the pipeline. All this was because federal and state government orders. Was it an attempt, Lindsay asks, to frustrate the construction of the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline? Then came 1976 and the last 6 months of the construction of the line. Here I was as chaplain in the midst of what appeared to be a planned frustration. If I may use the word without being misunderstood, there was apparently a plot to keep that oil from flowing. At the same time, all across America, there were lines of people standing and waiting for fuel. There was talk of rationing, and yet there was plenty of oil in Alaska, and apparently there was a frustration to prevent it from being used. The oil companies were doing their utmost. With all their power, they were attempting to complete this pipeline and to supply oil for the people of our nation. Private enterprise has always done that from the beginning of this great nation. Now that we had come to the last 6 months of the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline construction, it seemed that everything went wrong. Suddenly there was another turn. Someone had said that the welding on the big pipe was faulty. But how could that be? He says, I had watched day after day, almost daily, in order to rub shoulders with the men as much as possible. I had driven up and down that long stretch of pipe where they were welding it together. I knew the men, the welders, and the other men who were laboring there. Many of them were worshiping in my services week after week in the 7 camps from Galbraith Lake to Prudhoe Bay. These included the men who actually were welding, as well as the men who were x-raying the welds. I asked them, are those welds on that pipe faulty? And then only months from the completion of the whole project, there was this possibility that the whole big pipe would have to be redone from beginning to end. Folks, we're talking about 800 miles of pipe. And the government was saying it was going to have to be redone from beginning to end. Where it went under the riverbed, it would have to be dug up. Can you imagine the destruction of the ecology, he asks? If such a thing was to take place, the suggestion was that it had to be dug up where it had already been laid in the ground under the streams. At this time of year, that would have been almost literally an impossibility, for it would have destroyed the fish, streams, and the breeding grounds, and that is what the ecologists hollered. They insisted, it can't be done now, you must wait. After all, we don't dare touch those streams at this time of year. It was clear that a deliberate attempt was being made to stop the flow of that oil to prevent the whole project from being brought to a successful conclusion. It seemed that the intention was that it would never be produced. The plan became increasingly clear and the tension increased every day. The company that was x-raying the big pipe was accused of duplicating film. The charges were simply not substantiated. To the best of my knowledge, there was not one single leak after the oil went through, but you never heard it told that way. You never heard it told later that all those millions spent at that time were spent unnecessarily. That received no publicity. It became clearer that all of this was somehow planned. For 2 to 3 months, all we heard was faulty welding. The word went out across the media that the pipeline had to be stopped and even dug up. America was told that the oil would leak out under the ground and it would destroy the precious tundra. The news media proclaimed that this would be the biggest oil spill ever known on the face of the earth and it must be stopped. 3 years later, after the completion of the project, the flow of oil, you've heard of no oil spills except those which were produced by people who attempted to sabotage the pipe after the oil actually began to flow. You find no streams north of the Brooks Mountains with oil flowing into them because of the oil seeping from the ground where the pipe was laid. No, because there was no faulty welds in those pipes. He says, I am not merely giving an opinion. I had it from a thoroughly acceptable witness, as we shall see later on. He says, sometimes it seems that things happen just by chance. But I do not accept that. He says, I am a great believer in divine providence, that God can and does guide those who seek to follow him. Thus, I believe that what I'm about to relate was part of a divine overruling. Let me start from the beginning. I have said that as chaplain of the pipeline, I was responsible for 7 camps, all of the camps north of Brooks Range from Galbraith Lake Camp to Prudhoe Bay. Each day I had a worship service in a different camp 7 days a week. The camps were approximately 35 to 40 miles from each other. This meant that I traveled each day from camp to camp, and upon arriving I would check in with the registration desk. The lady at the desk would attempt to give me a room by myself if possible, because of my position as chaplain. I had to do a great deal of counseling, and clearly it was desirable to have a room where privacy was possible. On this particular day, however, I arrived at Franklin's Bluff Camp, and the lady at the desk said, I would very much like to give you a room by yourself, but we are just filled up today, and it is not possible. And I said to the lady, thank you. I understand the situation. I do not mind at all sharing a room with someone else. She handed me a room number on a slip of paper, as she normally did, and I thought very little about it as I walked down the corridor toward the dorm section. I walked into the 52-man dorm down the hallway and started to enter the room to which I had been assigned. There was an immediate protest from someone inside the room I was entering. A gentleman came to the door and said, I'm sorry, but you can't stay here. I replied, sir, I'm very sorry. I didn't mean to intrude. At this point, the man walked out of the room and said, you'll have to go back to the desk and get reassigned. I turned and started to walk away. And as I did, he said, hey, by the way, who are you? I said, I'm the chaplain with the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, and I'm assigned to this camp. The gentleman smiled and said, well, chaplain, I think you just might be interested in this, since you're a reverend. And then I asked him, why? Why did you not want me to enter the room? After all, I don't want to intrude any place where I should not be. The gentleman explained that he was appointed by Alyeska and the federal government to examine the so-called faulty welds. The claims that the welds in the big pipe were faulty and had been spread all over the country by the news media, in the newspapers, on radio, and on television. It was put out for the whole world to know that the welds were bad. Every so feet of the pipe must be welded, and the federal government had claimed that many of the welds were faulty and that as a result there would be leaks when the oil was flowing. He says, remember that the pipeline was both above and below ground. From Prudhoe Bay to Valdez was approximately 800 miles. The estimate was that approximately half of the pipeline in the distance was under the ground, and the other half was above the ground. To check the faulty welds, as the federal government wanted, would mean digging up of virtually hundreds of miles of the oil pipeline. Each of these welds was supposed to have been x-rayed prior to the pipe being laid in the ground. Indeed, the problem was even more serious than simply going underground. Much of the pipe was actually underneath riverbeds. This, therefore, would have literally multiplied millions of dollars for the pipeline to have been dug up and x-rayed again. All the x-rays of the welds prior to the pipe being laid in the ground were undertaken by a firm that was subcontracted by Alyeska. Another highly relevant fact was that these instructions to investigate the welds came up only 6 to 9 months before the projected date of oil flow. Obviously, such an undertaking would have caused great delay, and the cost would be enormous. The claim was that the company that was supposed to have x-rayed these welds had duplicated their film, and in so doing had cut back on their own costs, but had not done the job properly. It should be pointed out that when every joint of pipe was put together, the weld had to be x-rayed, and the company had films to prove that the x-rays had been carried out. With that background, let me go back to the gentleman in the room who had protested my entrance. I still did not know the man's name, but now he smiled at me. Reverend, come on in. As we walked across the dimly lit room, I noticed a light table on which there were placed many strips of film. He explained that these were the film strips which represented the welds on each joint of the big pipe. This 4-foot pipe that was to carry the crude oil from Prudhoe Bay to Valdez is the largest diameter pipe ever constructed for the carrying of crude oil. As the gentleman pointed to the light table, I remarked, "Sir, I know nothing about x-raying the welds on a big pipe. Would you please tell me what all of this is and why it's so secret?" The man said, "Chaplain, you've heard about the faulty welds on the big pipe?" I said, "Yes, sir. Anybody who listens to the radio, watches TV, or reads a newspaper has heard about that." He said, "Chaplain, my purpose is in coming here is to examine those welds." He says, "All of this is classified." I asked, "Do you mean that no one is supposed to see these films?" He responded, "Chaplain, until this matter is settled, it could be very drastic. It's of national importance." The gentleman was cordial by now, and he took considerable pains to explain what he was involved in. I asked him what was on those films. I asked him what on those films would show whether a weld was good or bad. He took a picture and pointed out a good weld, and then put it beside it a picture of a bad weld. The bad weld appeared to have bubbles internally. I asked, "Do you mean to tell me that an x-ray can pick up a bubble inside a piece of metal?" He replied, "Yes, because it's the type of x-ray that we undertake is done with radioactive material." As I compared the pictures, I could see a dark crusty area to a normal layman, it appeared to have what looked like a bubble. On the picture, a good weld looked exactly like a good weld on the outside of a piece of metal would look. Remember, he says, "I'm talking about how this looks to a layman." The gentleman told me that what had to be proven was whether or not each weld had actually been x-rayed. I realized as he talked to me that this was very important, and I spent a great deal of time going through the details with him as he explained various points to me. It should be stressed that I was shown these x-rays without any coercion on my part. I did not so much as ask to see them, and he at no time asked me to keep secret what he showed me or anything he told me. He did allow me to share the room with him that night, and we talked at considerable length. In the course of our lengthy conversation, it became very clear that this gentleman believed that the whole investigation was unwarranted, that there was no truth to the claim that there were faulty welds, and that it was costing the oil companies millions of dollars for this investigation. He had already been through most of the films, and he had simply not come up with any evidence to demonstrate the validity of the claims that had been made relating to the welds. One other point of background is that this gentleman told me that there had been an agreement between Alyeska Pipeline Service Company and the federal government to appoint him as examiner for these welds. It had been mutually agreed that his decisions would be accepted by both sides. Some federal inspector, hidden in anonymity, had claimed that the welds were faulty, but here was the expert, mutually agreed to by both parties, insisting that the federal inspector's claims were false. Sometimes in these matters of high policy, sacrifices are made, and there are even those who become scapegoats. The company that had been challenged as to its integrity in this matter of the welds was actually dismissed by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company and paid off. Another company was appointed to continue to work, and thus a compromise was reached. This was reported as being a face-saving operation, but in fact, the gentleman with whom I shared the room that night made it quite clear to me that basically the charges had no substance. During the evening, we talked at length about what was happening at this mammoth project was nearing, as this mammoth project was nearing its completion. It again appeared that somewhere underlying the total picture was an attempt by the government to postpone the flow of oil. I was left with the clear impression that government intervention was quite deliberate in an attempt to lead the oil companies to financial chaos, even to their bankruptcy and ultimately to the nationalization of the oil industry. We shall elaborate as we proceed in a later chapter. As I left that man the next day, I kept thinking about the things I had seen and heard, and I attempted to put the pieces of the puzzle together. Time went by, and it was later proven by the actual flow of oil that the welds were not faulty. To my knowledge, there was no leak that developed in the pipe at any point as a result of the faulty weld. Nevertheless, the fact is that the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company was instructed by the federal government to dig up certain points of the pipe at extreme expense to re-x-ray the welds and to relay the pipe. Alyeska had no option but to obey, so they did it. At this point, I was told by Mr. X that cost overruns were going to bring the total of the pipeline to $12 billion. Remember that originally the pipeline was supposed to cost $600 million, then $2 billion, but $10 million extra cost as an overrun? Five times the original estimate? Why? What is the underlying motivation? What absurd policy is the federal government pursuing? Why are you paying approximately $1.50 a gallon, and folks, it's a lot more than that now, as you know, at the gas pump? One reason was that there was a concerted effort to ruin the oil companies, bring them to bankruptcy, discredit them in the eyes of the people, and ultimately nationalize the oil industry. That became even clearer as those rich oil men from Saudi Arabia, as well as the bankers from the lower 48 states, began to come to Prudhoe Bay in large numbers. We're running out of time, folks. I want to give you that 800 number one more time. Order this book. Order this book, even if it's to give it to somebody else to let them know what's going on. The Energy Non-Crisis by Lindsay Williams. The number, 800-321-2900. 800-321-2900. Again, 800-321-2900. Ladies and gentlemen, the information that I'm sharing, America needs to have this information. We all need to get this message out. I want to continue here. He says, now I was deeply suspicious. I find myself going over the conversations I had with that gentleman time and time again. In my mind's eye, I saw bubbles on X-ray photographs, and I compared good and bad welds. I went over and over the things he had told me. I became convinced, to quote an old saying, all was not right in the state of Denmark. Then I remembered something else. In my mind, I went back to the conversations between Mr. X and Senator Chance, conversations in which I had participated, that had been 1.5 years prior to this time, but suddenly I saw tremendous developments relating to some of the things Mr. X had said at the time. I decided I would put some answers to them. What follows is an approximate recall of the questions and answers between Senator Chance and Mr. X. And keep in mind, this Mr. X he's talking about, he's protecting his identity, but it was one of the chief oil executives. He says, 1.5 years earlier, if you like, this is the good old-fashioned flashback method. The question and answers went like this. Senator Hugh Chance had asked, Mr. X, how much oil is there on the north slope of Alaska? The guy responded, I'm persuaded that there is as much oil there as there is in all of Saudi Arabia. Senator said, if there's that much oil there, then there is not an energy crisis. And Mr. X's only answer was a smile, implying that Senator Chance had hit the nail on the head. The senator continued, Mr. X, what do you think the federal government is really out to do? He said, Senator, I personally feel that the American government wants to nationalize the oil companies of America. The senator asked, then Mr. X, if you are so convinced of that fact, have you calculated how long you can remain solvent with the present federal control? Mr. X was reluctant to answer at first, but then he looked at Senator Chance and said, yes, we are so convinced that in fact we as oil company executives have made that calculation. The senator asked, then how much longer do you think you can remain solvent? The executive said, until the year 1982. Then if what you say is true, why don't you oil companies warn the American people of what is going on? After all, it's your neck that's at stake. The oil executive responded by saying, Senator, we can't afford to tell the truth because, Senator, if the federal government already has so many laws passed and regulations imposed on us as oil companies that if they decided to enforce these rules, they could put us into bankruptcy within 6 months. Sir, we don't dare tell the truth. Lindsay says, in passing, we point out that in our later chapters we shall explain how all this ties in with apparent millions of dollars in profits made by the various oil companies today. There is an explanation, and it is mind-boggling. That was the conversation virtually word for word as I remember it. The conversation cannot be denied. Senator Chance and I were both there, and we publicly and privately made it clear that the conversation did take place just as I have recorded it. Now, I was in an unexpected situation. Here we were approaching the end of the time on the pipeline, and there was a story that must be told. Mr. X had understood 1.5 years previously that the American government was out to nationalize the oil companies. He had seen it long before I did. But now I understood that too. Should I remain silent? And even if I talked, would anybody believe me? Should I be prepared to open my mouth because I, as a true American, believe in the free enterprise system? Would there be danger, maybe even physical danger? And would there be attacks against my spiritual ministry if I did open my mouth as to the facts that were taking place all around me? And folks, we got to go. We're out of time, and I'm sorry we have to leave you hanging there. But if you order the book, you won't be hanging. And maybe I'll share a little more of this on Monday. I got to try to wrap this up by next week because there's other things happening in the world. But I'm taking the time to do this because I think it's very relevant and very important. 800-321-2900 is the number. 800-321-2900. God bless you. Have a good night.
And the velvet wall at night moves in, wraps around you like a wall of stone. Just when your final prayer has flown, love will get there. When a mother's touch is far away, you close your eyes and you hear a voice whispering, it'll be okay. Just hold on for one more day. Love will get there. Change it all with just one smile. Love will get there.